When I was 10, my family lived on Sullivan's Island, a narrow sandbar at the mouth of Charleston Harbor. We had a simple house on the dunes, surrounded by seagrass, with a screened porch facing the Atlantic. In the morning, I watched the fishing boats chug into the waves and disappear over the horizon. During the slave trade, Sullivan's Island was not a child's oceanside paradise. It was a holding pen for slaves. The slave ships came from Angola, the Congo, Gambia, Sierra Leone, aiming for this beach. The dead were thrown overboard. Those in good health were sold when the ship docked. The sick slaves were brought to Sullivan's Island and locked up in what was called a pest house. If they died, they were buried in a mass grave. If they got well, they too were sold in Charleston. I used to collect shells here, and once, among some sand dollars, I found a bone. It was a little bone, bleached white from the sun. It looked like it was part of a hand or a foot. I'm sure it was a seagull bone or a chicken bone from a barbecue. My parents, my brother and I moved away from South Carolina. My father, an Episcopal priest, had been assigned to a new church. I lost touch with Charleston, but something about this beach called me back. It's June 1993. A chartered boat edges through the shallows of the Cooper River, 35 miles northwest of Charleston. This is the first day of the Ball family reunion, a three-day affair to pay homage to our ancestors, the Rice Grandees. All told, there are about 150 of us in attendance.
The Ball family isn't about to die out in a hurry unless somebody drops the atom bomb near Charleston.
We're navigating through the old rice planting region, craning our necks to see what remains of the plantations that once lined the river. Later, we swill bourbon at a reception in an old meeting house. We attend church in an old chapel where six generations of Ball planters had worshipped. And on one very scholarly day, we gather in a 200-foot geodesic dome to hear lectures by family historians and study exhibits about the old plantations. The Ball story is one that each of us has heard since childhood. It began in 1698. That was the year that my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Elias Ball, came over from England, arriving in the colony of Carolina to accept his inheritance, one half of a plantation called Cumming Tea. Moving quickly, Elias acquired more plantations, a family, and 100 slaves. Late in life, he commissioned a portrait of himself in which he wore a red velvet hat.
We always called him Red Cap because of that little red cap he wore to hide his bald head. The Balls are noted for being bald-headed.
That painting of Elias and his hat became the first emblems of a family's sense of entitlement. The next Ball generation copied Elias's example, and before long there were 10 rice plantations owned by the Balls on the banks of the Cooper River, with names like Midway, Pimlico, Whitehall, Marshlands, in addition to the first one, Cumming Tea.
Hyde Park was owned by Elias Ball. Kensington was owned by John Ball. Limerick was owned by Isaac Ball. Quinby was owned and up.
After my father's death, when I was 12, I had little contact with the Ball family. Years later, when I visit Charleston, I come as a New Yorker, a Yankee. Over the years, I've heard a lot about the Balls, but I never heard much about the slaves. There were 2,088 people born into slavery on Ball plantations between 1800 and 1865, plus many others bought at auction. Similar numbers stand from the previous century. I feel compelled to find out more about my family's role during the slave period. To this day, my motives aren't clear to me, but when I look across the rice fields where thousands of people worked, I want to hear their story told alongside my family's tale.
You're looking straight back at Rice Oak, which was a neighboring plantation.
I want to find descendants of people who worked on the Ball plantations. Would that be hard to do?
You're talking about the darkies? To find out where they are? That'd be almost impossible.
I think it'd be next to impossible to find anything of any consequence. I think it'd be next to impossible.
Two months later, in the heat of August, I returned to Charleston in search of this other story. I start with my older relatives.
Hello, Elias. Edward Ball.
How you doing?
Pleasure to see you.
See you. Come on in.
Elias Ball Bull, a distant cousin of mine. Elias, now in his 70s, is probably the 20th male in the family with that name. I find him seated in his black aluminum wheelchair.
You want to sit in the wheelchair? I'll move.
We meet in his four-room apartment on the outskirts of Charleston. Elias is well known in the family for being crotchety. He has sensitive eyes, a huge jaw, and a paunch that rides up over his belt to fill his white cotton shirt.
Okay, what you want to ask?
For 50 years, Elias has been studying antebellum records. The harvest of his research spills out of filing cabinets and lines the walls. He has a memorable laugh and can always be counted on for a straight answer.
What did the Balls do during the Civil War?
He fought. Sorry about that.
I press him for details and hope for the unexpected. Life on the plantations.
Aye.
About how many slaves do you think could work?
That cannot be answered. It depends upon the size of your rice fields.
It's jarring to hear someone talk so easily about slavery. I realize that the memory of the plantation era, at least for some people, is still fresh. In the deep country, Elias says, the ratio of slaves to whites reached 10 to 1. The landed gentry felt isolated by blackness.
May not see another white person for 6 months. And nobody they could associate with. Nobody. You did not associate with your overseer and definitely not with your slaves. So therefore, it just leaves them. And that was it.
So it was lonely for the white people.
Yeah.
There's one white family.
Yeah.
And there was a white family of overseers.
Yeah.
Then there were 100 slaves.
Or whatever, yeah. And that's it.
The slaves had their own society of
actually, they weren't the ones that got lonely, because they had each other. But the poor white people were the ones that were very lonely there.
They had it hard.
Yeah.
At the outbreak of the Civil War, the Ball men enlisted in the Confederate Army. Isaac Ball, my great-grandfather and the ancestor of almost all my relatives, fought in North Carolina. Back home, the end came when General Sherman's army arrived, burning everything in sight. But the Ball plantations were spared the torch because Sherman was friends with the Cooper River planters. Elias tells me that most of the slaves who worked the Ball plantations stayed on as sharecroppers. He tells me that near Coming Tee, the oldest Ball plantation, there is a village populated by descendants of Ball slaves.
The settlement is called, I can't remember the name of the little settlement. It's on Hardscrabble Road or one of them. It's still there. The Balls still live. The Ball Negroes still live there. I've forgotten the name of that community.
A few minutes later, he remembers.
It's called Sawmill. If you go there and ask them where's Sawmill, they can tell you.
My first lead, Sawmill, Hardscrabble Road. They didn't appear on any maps. At some point, I would have to find them. As for Elias, except for our goodbyes, this clue was the last thing spoken between us. He dies a few months after our conversation. It's a couple of days since I met with Elias, and I'm in the research room of the South Carolina Historical Society. I'm sitting at the head of a long wooden table, my computer at the ready. But what I find is so fascinating and upsetting that I can't seem to write. The first file I request from the librarian contains deeds for land and contracts for slave purchases by the Balls. One page concerns an auction in 1825, when a Ball heiress bought 100 slaves in one bid. For the sum of $70,735, it's agreed to deliver to Ann Ball the following slaves: Morris, Philip, Minus, Marcus, Elsie, Lavinia, Fortune, Cuba, Hester, Tilla, Isaac, Betsy, Scipio, Linda, Fortune.
You can go through any of these and get the names of hundreds or thousands of people who were owned by the Ball family at one time or another.
Steve Hoffius is director of publications here at the Historical Society. He tells me that in most cases, a planter would buy two or three slaves at a time. It was very rare to buy 100 people at once.
You run into a question of who named these people? Did they name themselves, or did the masters name them? And it went either way. I mean, both were fairly common.
Are there any records of surnames for slaves?
No, slaves rarely, if ever, had surnames. So all the records you're going to find are going to be first names only.
Bella, Lazarus, Flora, Celia.
It's really kind of overwhelming.
Martin.
Wait till you make contact with them.
Caesar, Hammond, Rosetta, Nelson, Anselm, Dickey, Adonis, Tenna, Friday, Carolina, Judy, Jacob, Felix.
It's lunchtime at the Cooper Hall Retirement Home. There are about 75 tables with starched tablecloths, surrounded by dark wood chairs with green and white striped upholstery. I'm here with Dorothy Dame Gibbs. Mrs. Gibbs is 88. She has white hair, wears a blue patterned dress, and stoops over her food. Her relation to me is the typically Byzantine one that you get in a family like ours. She explains that we're connected through my great-grandfather, Isaac Ball.
He was a cousin of Maria Louisa Gibbs, who was the mother of John Cumming Ball, the father of Ann Simmons Ball, my mother-in-law.
Dorothy spent her youth visiting old Ball plantations like Hyde Park and Middleburg. Older people she knew there had been born into slavery.
I think slavery was morally wrong. I think it always has been. It was wrong in Bible times, but it existed.
The conversation shifts to my finding descendants of the slaves. I tell Dorothy about the difficulty that I'm having trying to locate people by researching names.
They change names in a very confusing way.
Why did they change their names so much?
Why do Negroes do anything? I mean, that's a different culture, and you're doing very well if you can even learn what their culture is. You can't explain it all. White people have no secrets from Negro servants. And Negroes have a lot of secrets from us. But one reason the names become so confused is that they really, more consideration is given to breeding farm animals than to Negroes. They live and cohabit with anybody that suits them.
Are you talking about 200 years ago? Or
I'm talking about any time, right on down now to today.
In the Historical Society, I had found the probate records of John Ball, who died in 1817. His personal library was inventoried. It included a few manuals on slavery, but many books about ancient Italy and Greece. Like many of his peers, John Ball had studied the classics, and when naming his slaves, he drew on his education.
All of the classical names, Catullus, Julius, Caesar was very common.
As well as Scipio.
Scipio was a very common name.
Scipio Africanus, the black Roman general from 200 BC. A master found humor in naming his slaves after a conqueror. I had seen the name Scipio on several slave lists, and now Dorothy remembers a man by that name from her husband's tales about the Balls. She tells me that from time to time, people would come from the north to visit one of the Ball plantations. The Yankees were often critical of slavery and questioned the legal ban on education for black people. So Mr. Ball would call over one of his young slaves, Scipio, and ask him to recite Latin poetry.
He said, "Scipio, come here a minute. Tell this gentleman carpe diem." Said, "This boy really knows a lot of horrors. What about carpe diem?" So the little boy recited carpe diem word for word, which he had previously taught him. Much to the astonishment of the person from New England, say, "Well, I didn't know you did that."
Scipio had learned Horace by rote.
Yes, he hadn't had any more idea what he was talking about than I would know if I recited Sanskrit. Of course, it was a joke to Mr. Ball.
Dorothy goes on to tell me, however, that the Balls, as slave owners, were gentle masters.
My impression is that a good deal of consideration was given to the personal needs of the slaves as people.
She repeats the family lore on the subject, that slave families were not broken apart by sale, that there was little brutality and no interracial sex.
The Balls were all, fairly kindly people. Maybe they were ideal, or maybe I just heard the good things. I don't know. That's perfectly possible, you know. Families very seldom admit wrongdoing.
For the next several months, I visit archives in the South to study plantation records that might lead me to the descendants of people enslaved on the Ball plantations. With a friend, I call and write hundreds of likely families and end up following several false leads. Back home in New York, I begin to wonder whether I'm wasting my time. In January, I publish an article in an African American newspaper in Charleston, The Chronicle, describing my search. 2 days later, I receive a letter from Mrs. Luzina King about her mother, a woman named Emily Frayer, who is 93 years old. Mrs. King writes, "My mother's grandmother was enslaved on Limerick Plantation. So was my mother's grandfather. My mother is named for your great-aunt, Marie, of Logan Street. Hopefully, Luzina King." In February, I travel to South Carolina one last time. I visit Mrs. Frayer, who lives on a busy avenue near downtown Charleston. Her large house was once a corner grocery store. When I arrive, her daughter, Luzina King, is waiting at the door.
"How are you?"
"Hi, how do you do?"
Mrs. King leads the way inside the house, past a staircase, through sliding wooden doors, into a large living room. There are cabinets and shelves lined with books and family memorabilia. At the end of the room, Mrs. Frayer awaits me.
"I'm Edward Ball."
"So much to talk about."
"How do you do?"
"I'm fine, thank you. I'm feeling much better now."
Mrs. Frayer and I sit at a long dining table surrounded by her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. She tells me she was born on an old Ball plantation before the rice fields were put to rest.
"I was born on Hyde Park in 1901.
"In January?"
"January 30th, 1901.
"Do you have early memories of that place?"
"When I was a child, they used to plant rice in Hyde Park. And I used to sit in the door, and I was small, and I watched all day. Watching them people haul rice all day."
I tremble a bit, awaiting her next remark. I'm carrying part of the story, but I don't know what part Mrs. Frayer is carrying. She tells me about another Ball place, Limerick, which my great-grandfather Isaac might have inherited had the Civil War ended differently.
"My parents are from Limerick."
"My father's grandfather was a man called Isaac Ball."
"Yeah, I hear a lot about him."
"He's known in the family as Isaac the Confederate because he fought in the Civil War."
"Yeah, yes, I said all right."
"Did they ever talk to you about Limerick?"
"My grandfather was sold from Limerick and went to Stony Landing. And then he had a family there. And he left his family in Limerick. So he had two family. And when he died, he left two sets of children."
"So on Limerick, your grandfather left a family, and he moved to Stony Plantation."
"Yes."
"And he started another family."
"Yeah, they see, he didn't left, they sold him. Because they've been selling you this like you sell your chicken. That's the bit they've been doing. That was all the time."
"Tell him about it at night. Uh-huh. What happened at night?"
That's Emily Freer's daughter, Luzina King.
"Didn't he come
back?" "Oh! He used a boat to visit his two family, from one family to the other. Now when time to come home, he used the boat from there, and when time to go back, he used the boat and go back. But he keep up with the two families." "That's the way he did."
"He came under the cover of night."
"That's it. That's what it all do. That's the way they do, and they bury the dead in the night. And my grandmother says he could hear the people screaming in the night. Big fire light, burying the dead.
enslaved people buried their dead at night?
Yeah, they had to, because they had to work in the day. So they ain't got time for burying no dead in the day. If you dead, you wait till night for bury. I am telling, that was an awful time, wasn't it? No, man, slavery time is no time, no joke at all. Oh, when did I tell you? And we were just little children around the fire when she tell us that. Little children sitting out by the fire.
You know, I talk to my relatives, and one after another, they say that the balls were gentle masters. Now...
my grand-aunt, my grandmother's sister. You see, they had an overseer. Well, this overseer do all the licking. And when he start to whip my grand-aunt, she hit him back.
Then what happened?
He was so mad. The morsel step in. Said, no, you cannot lick her. Said, I'll lick Rachel myself.
And did the master lick Rachel?
Yes, he lick him. He said, no, you don't touch him. Said, I'll lick him.
What was the name of that master?
Oh, no, yeah, the master was the boy.
A family is made up of what it remembers and what it forgets. But most important are the things families would like to forget. Mrs. Freyer moves to her last story, her grandmother's memory of emancipation. The day came when the Union troops arrived on the lawn of the plantation owned by my ancestors.
My grandmother, she said she was 12, and she said she was standing in the door, and the Yankees, she said, come through and take her hat off. She said she had a skull cap on, and he threw them up. He pick them off her head and throw them up. He said, you're free as a bird in the air. She said, you drop on her knee. And said, thank God. I declare we just be children and cry from all we hear. We're going to hear.
But it was freedom was coming, right?
Yeah, that was freedom. That was when the Yankee come to. He find everybody who been hiding and tell them, you're free.
I'm at the ruins of the big house at what was once Cumming Tea Plantation. The house is about 50 feet wide and 20 feet deep. About a 20-foot length of a dead pine tree has broken off and fallen into the middle of the old house, which is a shell. I've come back to the first ball plantation, 35 miles inland from Charleston. It's almost 300 years since Elias Ball settled here. On my first trip, my elderly cousin, Elias Ball Bull, had given me a clue, and then he died. He said there was a community called Sawmill that arose from the ruins of this plantation, and that it was near a place called Hard Scrabble Road. If Sawmill exists, it would be about shouting distance from here. I searched the two-lane blacktops and dirt paths of Berkeley County, near Cumming Tea. I stop at the general store in the nearest town, Cordsville, and ask directions. The shop is a white wooden shack by a railroad track.
Do you know how to get to Sawmill from here? Is that, that's a little, it's only 10 houses there or something. Is there a Sawmill Road? Have you heard of something called Hard Scrabble Road? No?
Hard Pinch.
Hard Bench?
Hard Pinch.
Hard Pinch Road. Is that down there too? Same direction.
I follow the directions and I find Sawmill, which is no more than 15 houses arranged around a cinder block church. I start knocking on doors, asking people about their ancestors. I expect folks to slam the door on me, and a couple do. After a day of talking to strangers, I'm led to Mrs. Georgiana Richardson. She's 85 and lives in a three-room house on a dirt road no more than 5 miles from Cumming Tea.
Mother, this is Mr. Ball. This is the man that wanted to talk to you about Cumming Tea.
Mrs. Richardson, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Mrs. Richardson's fingers are crooked and her palm a little rough. Most of her teeth on the right side are gone, and that cheek is sunken in from an operation. Her eyes are clouded, but her gaze is still penetrating as she stares me in the face through thick glasses.
My grandmother, great-grandmother, aunt, and uncle, all of them from Comity.
Your grandmother was in slavery on Comity?
Yeah, they were. I know they were. My sister was slave because they were old people. Old people.
Mrs. Richardson tells me about the history of the village of Sawmill. The freed people cut pine from the plantation to build their houses, she says. And because there were no bricks for the fireplace, they made chimneys from clay.
They take clay and build clay chimney.
And so when it rained,
they have to have fire so it wouldn't fall.
They'd have to build a fire so the chimney wouldn't run down the chute.
Down. That's right.
Why didn't they make a chimney out of brick?
Ain't had none. Ain't got none. You see what a time? Time, what a time. That's right.
A few miles from Mrs. Richardson is another dirt road, and at the end of it, I find a gray wooden house next to a pond. This is the home of Freddie Mae Smalls. There are chickens and dogs and kittens and other animals in the yard. When we meet, Mrs. Smalls tells me that her great-grandfather was in slavery on Middleburg Plantation, that after the Civil War, he purchased the land that we're standing on, and that the Balls were the family that had bought her great-great-grandmother off of a slave boat. Soon, Mrs. Smalls' husband, an affable man called Postal Smalls, comes home.
Well, I tell you, if enough to learn you today, you will learn enough today to write a book by yourself. If he's going to tell you where we come from.
Postal Smalls is 75, strong and fit, and wears a work shirt. Freddie Mae Smalls wears a house dress and slippers. She tells me about her life. She grew up on the farm handed down from her great-grandfather and soon met Postal Smalls. She got married and then, at 16, had a baby.
1941, 17th of January, I had my oldest daughter.
And so then, of course, you had all the housework and raising the daughter and
working
so on
the
like
field
that.
Too, and cut wood and haul wood and split rail. I did some everything I think almost a man did wrong home. That's right. And that's all I was raised up with.
And one half of the time, you couldn't get a job if you had the money to buy a job. I had to make a job, making moonshine liquor. Till I get caught 2 times, and then I had to quit. Got probation 2 times, and I quit with it.
I remember that my father used to talk about the Berkeley County moonshine that he and his friends would toss down. The stories I'm hearing more and more link up with my own. But there's one piece that doesn't fit, and that's the part about white and black sex, the strongest taboo. And suddenly, Mrs. Smalls brings it up quite openly.
Matter of fact, they said not that I can approve it now. They said that my great-granddaddy is Mary Ball's son. Mary Ball's brother's son. But I don't have no proof of that.
There's no proof, but there are stories. And the matter-of-fact way Mrs. Smalls suggests that we might be distantly related gives me pause. She lets it drop, and so do I. The day before leaving Charleston, I'm to see Mrs. Emily Freyer again. She's the 93-year-old woman whose daughter, Luzina King, had written me a letter. When I visited them several days before, I learned that Mrs. Freyer wanted to see Hyde Park, the plantation where she was born, one last time before she died. She hadn't been there since childhood.
Ooh.
It's a sunny Saturday morning at Hyde Park Plantation. Mrs. Freyer and a few of her relatives get out of their car onto a lawn overlooking the rice marshes of the Cooper River. There are 3 simple wooden buildings, the 190-year-old big house, and 2 smaller shacks.
I want to look for something.
We make our way across the sloping grass within sight of the old rice fields. Mrs. Freyer pays no attention to the big house on our left.
She looks 50 yards beyond it to a narrow wooden shack on a path that winds between some pine trees.
Oh, there's a house back there. That house in the back.
That little house.
Yeah, I wanted to see that house. If that's the house.
Hyde Park was owned by the Ball family and its intermarried relatives for 253 years. It was sold 3 weeks before our visit, the last plantation to go out of the family. We head for the shack, and Mrs. Freyer throws a glance at the old master's house.
That house seemed like it was done over. It was a bigger house than that. Oh, Lord, that's a long time.
I tell Mrs. Freyer that I have many relatives. I tell her that I can't speak for them, and that I'm speaking alone. I apologize to her for what my family did to her family. In the shadow of what actually happened, it is an inadequate and self-serving remark, but Mrs. Freyer receives it with grace.
You didn't have to wait now to come. You could come long time, but you come in due time at it. You, yeah, when you come in due time.
I came in due time.
Due time, you can explain yourself, and you can think, but a lot gone. They didn't even think about that. You'll mend many fences. You just keep up the work, boy. Keep them up. Because there's a lot to be done.
We approach the narrow shack. It's long, and the roof sags. It's the only house among many that survived. Weeds cluster around it like a skirt. Mrs. Freyer stops.
I was born in that one, I visit. That's the house been here.
You were born in this house?
Yeah, this house here I was born in. That's it. It wasn't but one chimney. And that chimney answered to the two side of the house. One family on this side window, one family on that side. And that was the house, all right. But it seemed like it was bigger than that.
Of course it looked bigger. You were
was bigger than
5 years old.
I wasn't even five.
Looking at her house, Mrs. Freyer breaks down crying. We stand amid thicket and pine, Mrs. Freyer leaning on her cane.
I'm thinking you took me because I had wanted to come a long time. A long time.
We stand together and weep. Mrs. Freyer gathers her strength and turns to me.
You weep sometimes because you're happy. And you weep sometimes because you mourn. So take choice.
Take your choice. I'm Edward Ball.
Time bring on changes. Time really bring on changes.
They're crossing the bridge.
Yes, boy. But God knows. I don't know the end.